Bueno, fíjate.
Million people will lose their jobs each month.
Quantity and no quality will be disciplined.
Recall the passage of this bill. Armageddon!
Listening to the queen of internet talk radio, Heather Bachman with Heather on the Hill.
Hello, America. I'm Heather Bachman, and welcome to another edition of Heather on the Hill. You know, I get approached a lot as a radio talk show host under the age of 35, asking me how is the new class going to survive in Washington without becoming Washington as usual. So I decided to create this episode reflecting and revolving around exactly that answer. And the answer of it is to keep them informed, and to give them the right tools that they know what needs to be done so they don't become Washington as usual. And that does not mean putting their cell phone numbers on a website. That means giving them texts, giving them newsletters, giving them phone calls, letters, and getting in touch with them and reaching out to them and telling them, this needs to be done, we need this to happen. And praising them when they do right, and taking care of a few things when they do wrong. That is the only way we're going to do it, and that's why this episode is so important. We have two great interviews today. The first one is with Ulysses K. Euler. He is not only the founder and president of the National Tax Limitation Committee, but he's also a co-author of the book Red State Uprising with Red State's Eric Erickson. The reason why I had Lewis on is because not only is his committee a guiding point for the new class, but also this book. And I've said before, we have to give them the right tools. And this book pretty much says, listen, Republicans and Democrats are both to blame, but now here's what we need to do to recreate the Republican Party so we can actually rejuvenate and renew this nation from within and not create a new party. The next interview is with Alexandra Merrill, and she is the author of the book Rules for Republican Radicals. The reason why I had her on is because Republican radicals are going to be a majority of the people, I think, that are actually going to hold the legislators' feet to the fire. And I wanted to talk to her about what we need to do as Republican radicals and as Tea Partiers and as people who are really trying to recreate and rejuvenate this nation from within and make sure that this new class does not become Washington as usual. And, you know, I've spoken to a lot of newbie legislators, and they've asked me, what do I need to do? I said, you know, continue to have town halls. Make sure you keep in contact with your with your constituents, and, you know, just watch your step, because the bottom line of it is that if you start trading votes, if you start listening to lobbyists and not listening to the people on the street, you're going to have some problems, just like Arlen Specter and Evan Bay. And another thing that I wanted to speak about when it comes to this is a personal story. I was on Fox News, and FoxNews.com is a strategy room, and we had Ben Quayle, Dan Quayle's son, who is now a legislator-elect, and they asked me to ask him a question, and the first question that came to my mind was, how are you not going to become Washington as usual? Because I think about that, not only as somebody who is a young conservative, but also as somebody who wants to run for office someday. I wonder how can you not become Washington as usual? And he had a really great response. He said, I'm going to be in Arizona, I'm going to commute, I'm going to be in contact with these constituents, I'm still going to be in this constituency, and I'm going to keep in touch, and I'm going to make sure that I do what I promised. And I said, that's all well and good, and I hope that does happen. But the bottom line of it is, and I said this to everybody who has ever asked me this question, the only way they are ever going to have a shot at making any changes in this nation, they're going to need our help. It's as simple as that. But anyway, let's get to the show. We'll be right back right after this, and then we'll get to Heather's Hot Topics. Then we'll have Lewis Euler, and then after that, Alexandra Merrill. You're listening to Heather Bachman, Heather on the Hill Radio. We'll be right back right after this.
This is Christopher Fredrickson, the 21st century Paul Revere, host of the Paul Revere Show and North Carolina senatorial candidate, and you're listening to Heather on the Hill with Heather Bachman.
Yes, you are listening to the Heather on the Hill program, heatherbachman.com, if you'd like to download this podcast. Also, feel free to go on my Facebook page, facebook.com/BACHMAN. And now on with the program. One of the biggest things that is going to obviously be on a legislator's mind, a newbie legislator's mind, is what issues and what legislation to support or to deny. And the lame duck session, which is already been an intriguing conversation piece, is going to be a reflection. It may not be a reflection, rather, of their obviously of their voting record, but it's going to be a reflection of what they're going to have to encounter. This is not, these legislators that are still going to be there are going to be their counterparts, their colleagues. So they have to watch this lame duck session for two reasons. One, to see what kind of legislation they may have to fight and appeal, or repeal rather, or fight against, and two, to also see the dynamics of the Senate and the Democratic House, because they may not be, they may be the minority, but they still have this mentality that they do well in their job, so they have to be something that has to be watched like a hawk. One big piece of legislation that I have gotten a lot of flack for not supporting, but do not support, is the DREAM Act, and I want to talk about that, because I recently saw this article, and I read articles from opposition too. You know, I've said this to many colleagues. I read everything. I read stuff from Republicans. I read stuff from Democrats. I read stuff from independents, from Green Party, whatever. I even read stuff from people who don't believe in the political agenda. But there is an article in the Politico recently. It was from Representative Mike Honda and Marcin Side, and it's called DREAM Act, Supporting Our Students. If you knew that by passing legislation to allow 2.1 million American students to pursue higher education or military service, our government could collect $3.6 trillion over the next 40 years, would you do it? We think you would. That's why we support the Development, Relief, and Education of Alien Minors Act. After years of advocacy, we are hopeful that it can pass the House and Senate before Congress adjourns in December. The DREAM Act is bipartisan, offering a conditional 6-year path to legal permanent U.S. residence for immigrant youth brought here as children. They need to complete high school, demonstrate good moral character, and complete at least 2 years of higher education or military service. Without the DREAM Act, about 65,000 students a year, honor roll students, star athletes, talented artists, and aspiring teachers graduate from high school and then hit a roadblock instead of entering college or the military and gaining upward mobility in higher education. They are forced to live in the shadows and work in low-paying jobs. This is complete crap. This is wrong. This is exactly what they think, want you to think it is. And this is the one thing that I hope and pray that our new legislators will see. They will say this to your face and be lying through their caps. Listen to the public. Listen to the people. These are the people that are going to be paying for this in more ways than one. And these are the people who have to support this. It's not the legislators, it's the people. And here's my position on the DREAM Act. It's amnesty. It is blanket amnesty. And here's how it works. They go to, they're in high school, right? They graduate from high school and they fill out a form. And the form goes through the process of figuring out whether or not they can have in-state tuition or go into the military. And then after that, get amnesty. But here's the kicker. They get amnesty as soon as they fill out this form. Why? Because Immigration and Customs Enforcement agencies, the same agencies according to an Arizona judge, already are overwhelmed by taking care of this nation's borders, will not get this form, will not be able to see it. It will be off limits to them. That's amnesty. If Immigration and Customs Enforcement actually can get a piece of paper, just one little piece of paper that states that this person's here illegally and they're not allowed to see it, that's amnesty. Number one. Number two, in-state tuition for people who are here illegally, while regular American citizens like you and I and my sisters who have paid out-of-state tuition and family members who have paid out-of-state tuition who were born and raised in America legally have to still pay out-of-state tuition. But because these people have such Democratic support, liberal support, they get in-state tuition through this piece of legislation. Now, if we are going to, and let me just say this. If we're not going to stand with out-of-state tuition, then abolish it. Abolish it for everybody, for every level. And that has been attempted and, of course, defeated because you cannot take care of American citizens. You have to take care of illegal aliens. It's disgusting. I spoke to a colleague of mine, and she says, but it's military, it's military, it's military. They have to go into the military. No, they either go into the military or they go into college. And here's the kicker. The forms, and I've said this more times than I can count, the forms are not shown by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agencies. As a result, we have illegal aliens getting in-state tuition, a cheaper rate to go to college, as an incentive to cross the border illegally. How hard is that to understand? We are actually giving them a reason not to follow our rules. That's the bottom line. I don't know why it's called the DREAM Act. I understand because it's the acronym, but it just doesn't make sense to me because it's not a dream. It's a nightmare. It is exactly what we cannot do in order to protect our borders. We cannot allow them to have an incentive to cross the border. And I know these are children. I know these are young adults. These are kids. And I'm sorry about that. But here's the bottom line. They're still illegals. No matter if they're 2 or 22 or 52 or 82. If they're here illegally, they're illegal aliens. There can't be a limit just because they're kids. There can't be a stop at enforcing our borders just because they're little ones. Because if that was true, then we'd be having people cross the borders with babies all the time because they know that nothing's going to happen to them. And we can't have that. I'm sorry, we can't have that. And I'm not saying the aspect of that these are bad people. They're not bad people. I don't think they're bad people. A lot of them are. But not all of them are bad people. A lot of them are criminals. A lot of them do want to attack this nation from within. But a lot of them just want a change in their life and a change in their future. And I see that. But come here legally. You know, I have, I shouldn't really be talking about this, but I'm going to anyway. My sister's boyfriend is a Mexican. And his family has a member of their family. He was born in America, but he's Mexican. And his family has members who waited 5 years for citizenship. And they had to go back and forth and they had to fill out forms and go to meeting and go to interviews. But I sat with him and I talked to him and I said, well, how did this family member feel? He actually said she was proud. She was proud when she became an American citizen. And I'm thinking to myself, we're taking that away. We're saying to them, don't come in as an American citizen. Don't actually be proud to be a part of this country. Don't have to learn about our history. Don't have to learn our language. You don't have to learn our language. You don't have to learn about our history. You don't have to fill out any forms. You don't have to go through the guidelines and principles we have stood by for decades. You can just cross. Just cross that border. Don't worry about it. We'll figure it out as we go along. Oh, you've got kids? Oh, we'll give them in-state tuition or we'll put them in the military. And then we'll give them blanket amnesty. And here's the kicker. And this is what really disturbs me. And this upsets me to no end. And I'm going to go into the next article, I promise, when I say this. there are so many other countries, including Mexico, who have such strict border requirements. I have seen the list of requirements for Mexico, and I have to say, I have scoliosis, my boyfriend has allergies, he also has sometimes breathing problems. I've had breathing problems in the past, and I have a couple of other physical issues, and I look at the list of requirements to even walk into Mexico, and my sister, as I said before, might be getting married in Mexico. As I've said before, Kit might be getting married in Mexico. I don't know if I'll be able to make the wedding because I don't think I'll be able to cross the border. But we as America, well, no. We can't protect our borders. I'm sorry, what? We may be the most powerful nation in the world. Maybe we may be the nation that at times is responsible to assist other nations. But that doesn't mean we're not responsible for our own nation's security and ability to know who is here, who is living here. It's not that hard to understand. Anyway, I'm going to get off my high horse and let's get on to the next hot topic, shall we? I recently read another political article entitled Parties Divided on the Lame Duck Issues by Meredith Shiner. And it talks about two other agendas of the Lame Duck Congress. And that is extending unemployment benefits and extending the Bush tax cuts. And although it kept talking about how they both of them don't feel like both one is the priority, one of them thinks this is the priority, one of them thinks that's the priority, the bottom line is at least they think both of them are priority because they intertwine each other. They both have to deal with the income and the livelihood of the American people. Unemployment benefits, because there are still people that are unemployed, including colleagues of mine who are still living on unemployment and need that unemployment in order to pay their rent and keep their homes. And we also have the Bush tax cuts. And if they're not extended, there's going to be a tax increase for everybody, not just the rich, everybody. And it's going to create a trickle-down effect. Now, let's talk about the Bush tax cuts first. The Bush tax cuts are a blanket of tax cuts for both rich, middle class, and lower class. And while the Democrats may believe that there is still such called thing as rich these days, $250,000 a year is not rich by any means. And I'm speaking from personal experience with people who I've interviewed on $250,000 a year. And these are small business owners. These are people that are also struggling. And these are people who are already paying a large amount of taxes. And I'm not, you know, I'm not supporting them because they're paying enough taxes. I'm saying because they're a majority of small business owners and business owners, period, that they need to be seen with a little bit more respect than being called, quote-unquote, the rich. We still have CEOs working for Burger King. We still have chiefs of organizations that are taking internships. We are not yet in the range where we even have, really, every CEO working for the top companies anymore. But nonetheless, when they are a CEO of a small business, they need to be shown a little bit of the same Bush tax cut leeway, or I should say allowance, that they were given before. Because the Bush tax cuts were a success, other than the so-called stimulus packages and shovel-ready projects, and they need to be shown with a little bit more respect than the Democratic Party is given. Now let's go on to the unemployment benefits. The unemployment benefits are obviously a hot topic, and I have gotten confronted about my support of unemployment benefits from many people, including family members, believe it or not. And they have said to me that if we continue to give them unemployment, they will continue to take unemployment. And I thought to myself, what an oxymoron. We continue to give incentives to illegal aliens and they keep coming. So if we're going to stop giving incentives to somebody, we should be stop giving incentives to them, not to American citizens. And unemployment, believe it or not, is actually a bad thing to a lot of people. I'll give you a great example. A colleague of mine is on unemployment. He's been living on unemployment since, I believe, February of this year. He occasionally is able to get off of it with some temp jobs, but most of the time he's on it. And I talked to him the other day, and he told me that his stomach was bothering him. I said, well, then go to the doctor. And he says, he can't. And I said, why can't you? He doesn't have health coverage. And I'm thinking to myself, he's on unemployment. He's on government support, but he makes too much money to get on health care. And we're so freaking out about this Obamacare that's already screwing with our nation. It's so backwards, it's almost disturbing. You know, the Bush tax cuts. We have these tax cuts already in a lot of incomes and a lot of people's income already. We already have it in people's financial agendas. Yeah, we're going to take it away because $250,000 is too much money to make. But these $250,000 people are majorly small businesses. And, you know, I do see the aspect of, you know, taking from the rich and giving to the poor. It is but we're not Robin Hood. We're America. We already have given these incentives. These incentives have worked because who are you going to have? And also, let's look at this aspect. If they're not small businesses, who are they? $250,000 plus people, what do they do with most of their money? They invest it. They put it in back into the economy. They buy things. Do you want a $250,000 family man who knows he's got to pay for, college tuition soon? So he goes into creating savings accounts, and he goes into pushing into the stock market and buying things? Or do you want a man who believes shovel-ready projects are not shovel-ready yet? Or are stimulus packages that end up costing us more than helping us? Who do you really want with this money? They have to look at that aspect too. But I digress. I'll go back to the unemployment benefits because that's the one that's really, really obviously stressing many people because a lot of people are starting to see the weeks dwindle down, including a couple colleagues of mine. And I've said to them, what are you going to do afterwards? And they said, they actually shake their head. They don't know. You know what happens? They're gonna have to go on. They're either gonna have to go on welfare, food stamps, or something, or they're gonna lose their jobs. They are lost their jobs. They're gonna lose their apartments, homes, and housing. Period. And we're gonna even have a worse situation. So obviously, the unemployment's a little more important. But when you look at the aspect of who's planning for what, both of them are of great importance. The article, as I said before, talks about them being divided. On other issues, the smallest number, this is from the article, on other issues, the smallest number of Republicans said allowing openly gay men and women to serve in the military, which translates into congressional action to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, was very important, while the smallest number of Democrats cited the extension of the Bush tax cuts. Independents, on the other hand, were more interested in keeping the estate tax from increasing significantly. Ladies and gentlemen, all three of these come down to one aspect. Talk to the people involved. If you want to discuss Don't Ask, Don't Tell, talk to a military official. Talk to people who actually live it day in and day out and ask them their perspective. Ask them what needs to be done. Because obviously, and this is exactly what happened with the Dodd-Frank bill. We gave the same people who screwed up the situation in the first place time to fix it, and we wonder why it failed. Because you can't give the same people that blew it last time a second chance when it comes to something as important as military or any political action for that matter. In the other avenue, with the Bush tax cuts and the unemployment, talk to the people. Ask them what they would do with the money. Ask the 250,000 people who are the small businesses how much they would invest into this, that, and the other thing, and give them incentives to do it. If we want to create this, reinvigorate this economy, let's get serious. Let's take the Bush tax cuts and add to it incentives to invest in the economy, in the stock market, to purchase bonds, to create some actual action within this economy that will actually create some positives. And I have to say this, who would you rather give the money to? Would you rather give it to a family man who has to buy things, who has to invest in the economy, who has to create savings accounts for this person and that person, this daughter and that son? Or do you want to give it to a president who still believes in his shovel-ready projects, even though we haven't even seen the shovels? And his stimulus packages, even though we see the debt clock actually running out of numbers in New York. Who do you want to give it to? Who do you really want to give this money to? Do you want to give this to a group of senators and Democratic senators who have already said 1,000 times that they don't read the bills they even sign? Or do you want to give it to an American who needs the money, an American who wants to put the money back into the economy, whether it's purchasing a car or investing in a house or investing in the stock market? And I know a lot of them don't invest in the stock market. A lot of them aren't, but you know, even the ones that aren't small business owners, they still will invest into this nation, whatever they do. And who would you rather have invest in this nation? An American citizen who has already planned to have this money, or a president who obviously doesn't know what to do with any of the power he has taken, except take more? Who would you rather give it to? If this program angers you, upsets you, intrigues you, makes you feel like a better American, please feel free to forward it to a friend via my website, heatherbachman.com, podcast powered by Podomatic, or feel free to visit me on my Facebook fan page. That's facebook.com/BACHMANHEATHER. We are now going to go into our interview right here live on Heather's Hotline with Kay Euler. He is the founder and president of the National Tax Limitation Committee, but more importantly, he is the co-author of Red State Uprising, the textbook, I hope, for the new class of representatives. And he's going to talk a little bit, obviously, about the book, but he's also going to get a little bit into the aspect of what needs to be done in order to make sure that this nation survives and thrives within this new class of representatives. Without further ado, live on Heather's Hotline, Lewis K. Euler.
There is an article recently, a book review of the book Red State Uprising, whose co-author is actually on Heather's Hotline today, and it starts with a interesting story. When Prime Minister Winston Churchill returned to No. 10 Downing Street after 6 years in the political wilderness, the icon was asked whether his newly formed conservative government planned to undo the economic handiwork of the outgoing socialist regime. Winnie reportedly responded by asking his questioner whether he had ever tried to unscramble an egg. On this side of the pond, in 2010, Eric Erickson and Lewis Euler have presented what amounts to an American manifesto that is all about the political unscrambling of eggs. Lewis, thank you for being on the program today.
It is our pleasure, Heather.
So is that your angle? Are you trying to unscramble the egg, so to speak?
Well, that's a good metaphor, but it is, you know, in many ways, that is what we're trying to do. We're trying to give some direction to the newly elected chefs in the Republican Party in the House to get them to do what Tea Partiers and our kind of organization, our National Tax Limitation Committee, wants done, our members want done, and that is very serious oversight, very serious review of all of the programs that we're spending vast sums on in Washington. And what we have to do is go about this in a very objective and systematic way, invite in the people who run these programs and demand of them to know how they're spending the money, what benefits we are deriving, take a look at the OMB's rating system for each of the programs, so that we get an assessment, a true evaluation of the effectiveness of programs, so we can eliminate some, cut some, devolve some, and fold some together, that so we get a real bang for our buck as taxpayers.
Let's jump ahead, because you were talking about programs, and one of my questions was about one of the programs you discussed, Social Security. Your book discusses, again, Social Security not only as it's seen in the current days, of course, but also in the past, and you talk about personal savings accounts. Now, how would you go about the process of this? Because it would have to be a revoke, a lot of revoking, a lot of repealing, a lot of defunding. How would you suggest doing this without affecting the national economic system?
Well, first, what we have to do is recognize that the current system truly is broken. Mm-hmm. It is nothing but a Ponzi scheme. That is, for us to be paying benefits to current recipients, we have to have the flow of money from the salaries of younger workers. So there is no trust fund. We have to recognize that. Then we have to look around the world and say, has some other country experienced this problem, and have they come to a solution? And there's one major example, and that's Chile, 30 years ago, took its broken Social Security system and converted it over time into a private ownership system, and it has worked beautifully, and about 12 or 13 other Latin American countries have followed Chile's lead. So the first step is to acquaint Americans with alternatives and begin a national debate on how we should reform Social Security for the benefit of our children and our grandchildren.
Absolutely, and I agree with that in many ways, shapes, and forms, especially as a 30-year-old that knows there will not be Social Security when I need it. Let's look at the aspect of another objective, and you talked a little bit about already how you want this to be a how-to guide for the new legislative class, and you talk about a really interesting segment of what's wrong with the government, and you use three amazing words: government, lobbying, government. How do you see this reflecting, how do you see this declining within the new class, and how would you keep the decline decline to occur?
How would I keep the new class focused on this?
Yes.
Well, I think they're already focused on it, and we just need to give them some tools. The Dick Armey designed some time ago the Base Realignment and Closure Commission. I think that design, which is a group of outside experts and independent commissioners, and create what we would call bureaucracy closure commissions. They would evaluate these various programs and make recommendations to the leadership in the House as to which ones should be consolidated, defunded, etc., mm-hmm. and make a package deal on many of these. That's one approach. Another approach is for the House to actually enforce its Rule 21, and that is that there shall be no appropriation without a current authorization from the policy committee that is involved.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, when we look at the number of dollars involved, it is huge. There are $290 billion worth of programs receiving current appropriations for which there is not a current authorization. And we must force the authorizing committees to either approve these programs or abandon these programs by an up or down vote.
Now, how would you consider the aspect, however, of, and I understand and appreciate that, but how would you consider the aspect of them being held up to some sort of standard by the American people? How would you be able to reflect that? I understand you have an outside committee, but the electorate, as it were, how would you see them be able to keep a hold on them through their own electorate?
Sure. First, what we need to do is make sure that as the House members proceed,
mm-hmm.
why they will keep the American people fully informed through the Internet, through the transparency of the Internet, so that we actually make collective decisions with the people providing direct input. Let them take a look at these programs and see the same evidence that is observed by the members themselves and get feedback from the people. And people across the country themselves, having been exposed to many of these programs, have their own criteria and their own experiences to share that will help us in this decision making.
You talk a little bit about RINOs, Republicans in name only, and although you name some names, there are some that a lot of people seem to reflect upon. How do you see, how would you describe a RINO, and how would you give us, how would you be able to suggest whether or not a RINO is running for office?
Well, we do have a number of people who lost in 06 and 08 to Democrat challengers who really were not hard-nosed fiscal conservatives. Fortunately, the new crop are pretty uniformly tough. But what we do need to do is make sure that some of the older Republicans that have been around for a number of terms, if they're going to be leaders in individual committees, we need to make sure that they make commitments to the younger members that they will be tough on spending issues.
What are the other reflections, or what are the other characteristics you would say is a conservative? We understand small government, personal responsibility, restructuring and or limiting actual taxation or spending, but I'm looking beyond the aspect into the social issues. Are they all pro-life? Are they all pro-states' rights, so on and so forth?
Well, it is clear that the base of the Republican Party has always been strongly pro-life, pro-family, and that is a very important a thing to perpetuate. And, you know, one of the aspects of taxing and spending that is little appreciated is that there is no more important issue for the average family than the taxes they have to pay or the programs that they have to confront that have a social impact through their schools, through all kinds of programs that are promoted by government at one level or another. The less we have to face government-promoted ideas of social conduct, the better off we're going to be as a nation. Let government shrink in size and in power and reinstall the power of the family.
A lot of your book discusses the possibility or perspective of a new party. And then you conclude to say, no, we don't really need a new party. We just need the Republicans to realize their foundations and their principles. Do you think this new class is the first step or the step to making that happen?
Well, we have made it clear in the book that third parties can be disastrous for us. We saw what Ross Perot did and helped elect Bill Clinton a while back. Other third-party candidates simply split the vote. What we need to do, and I think what we have done this time, is to nominate the most solid, fiscally conservative individual during the primary who can then be elected in the fall, helping to move the political center of gravity of the Republican Party in a more conservative direction. I think this election started that, and that's the way we should conduct ourselves in the future.
Now, in addition to being co-author with Eric Erickson, you also are the founder of an amazing taxation committee. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yes. I worked for Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California, and we helped devise the first tax and spending limit initiative in California. It has spread elsewhere in the country and is the model for the federal balanced budget tax limitation amendment. And out of that work grew our committee some 35 years ago, the National Tax Limitation Committee. And I invite people to come to our website, limit taxes, all one word, limittaxes.org, and see all the things that we're working on, and join with us in so many of these important crusades, including right-sizing government, about which we speak in the book.
Now, you talk, I'm just going to ask you this one last question, because I just got a question from an email. You talk a little bit about third parties. Do you believe that the Tea Party will evolve into a third party, or will it become an extension to the Republican right?
I think it has already demonstrated that it will be a not a political party, but it will remain a movement, moving the Republican Party and Republicans in the right direction, and it will help to guide and be a very, very effective rudder for what we're trying to do for fiscal conservatism.
Lewis Euler, author of Red State Uprising. Lewis, thank you for being on.
It's been our pleasure, Heather. Thank you.
This is Heather Bachman for Heather on the Hill. We'll be right back.
We Republicans don't lower our standards, so you Democrats up yours. You're listening to Heather on the Hill with Heather Bachman.
Back right after this.
Thank you so much, Lewis, for that great interview, and thank you so much, Christopher Walker Fredrickson, for my amazing promos and commercials. You are listening to Heather on the Hill, powered by Podomatic, live right here on FromTheRightRadio.com. I wanted to also invite you to obviously be on my Facebook fan page, where you can involve yourselves in the great debate that Obama doesn't want that I have on this program day in and day out, and that is HeatherBachman.com. or facebook.com/BACHMAN. Let's get on to the program, shall we? I hope this book, Lewis Euler and Eric Erickson's book, is definitely in the inauguration, or I should say the first day bag of every newbie legislator, because it pretty much says what we've been saying all along. Yes, we screwed up as a Republican Party, but we are the party of limited government. We are the party of personal responsibility. We just need to start showing it a little bit more, if anything, in a more brighter light. Alexandra Merrill is my next interview. She is the author of the book Rules for Republican Radicals. And although the word radical might sound a little to you, I honestly love that title because we have to be radicals. You have to realize something here. The mainstream is MSNBC, Chris Matthews, Keith Olbermann, and these people that just want to drill into your heads Obama's a great president when he's nothing but a newbie who has done nothing other than attack this nation from within. We have to be radicals because the mainstream, the narrowing, anti-American, pathetic mainstream is against us. And I'm not saying radicals in the way of burning flags or screaming or guns flaring. I'm talking about writing letter campaigns. I'm talking about rallies. I'm talking about policy involvement. I'm talking about reading the legislation that Nancy Pelosi won't read and finding out what's being done in your name. So in many ways, that is becoming radical because nobody has really done it. We have been stagnant in a Kool-Aid coma since the beginning of the Obama term, even before then, if you really want to get technical. And we have now woken up, but now we have to realize that we are no longer of the mainstream because the mainstream is against this nation as a whole. That is the bottom line. And that's what I want Alexander to talk about. Alexander's also been published in opeds.com and other online publications. And you have obviously have heard her on the radio as well. She's done amazing interviews, great interviews with other fellow radio hosts. And the one thing that I want to talk to her about, in addition to that, in her book, obviously, is what needs to be done. Because we have to be radicals. And I know I'm being a little bit of a broken record right now, but we do. There is no way, shape, or form that we are going to fix this country from within without being outside of the box. Because we have seen what's in the box. What's in the box is Nancy Pelosi. What's in the box is so-called health care reform like Obamacare. What's in the box is Harry Reid. What's in the box is Barack Obama. This is not people that are for this nation. That is, these are people that are for their own power only. And, you know, I am getting to the point where I'm just looking forward to seeing him go. Because I think time and time again about little things like what he gets to do to our nation and what he gets to lead and what he gets to get his hands on and what he gets to act upon and what he gets to move upon. And the lessening of the press conferences and David Axelrod leaving and Rahm Emanuel running for office, all this stuff is just snowballing up to the realization that this is not a president we want for another 4 years. If you'd like to listen to a podcast of this radio program, please feel free to visit my website, heatherbachman.com. Or if you want to talk about the debate on this program, please feel free to visit my Facebook fan page, facebook.com/BACHMANHEATHER. Now we have an interview with Alexandra Merrill. She is the author of Rules for Republican Radicals. She's going to talk about what needs to be done now that we have the House and what we can do to take the Senate at least from outside and take over this nation, because obviously the powers from within are not working out.
Alexandra, thank you for being on the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Tell us, what is a Republican Radical?
Well, to be honest, the book, even though it's titled Rules for Republican Radicals, really is about everybody taking back their power and sort of being a radical. You know, by definition, a radical is somebody who doesn't play by the rules. And right now, the rules are, you know, really anti-American. So a Republican radical is somebody who is looking to get back to those core principles, is willing to fight against sort of the socialist onset that, you know, that's really gripping our country right now.
Absolutely. I do talk about this a lot. Yeah, I do agree with you. Everybody's a Republican radical right now. And I think it's because the mainstream has become, like you said, so anti-American. And that not only is involving Obama and Pelosi and Reid, but we're also against Olbermann and Matthews and MSNBC. And it's very intriguing how I'm seeing some of their new ads talk about opinions must be earned. It's just obvious that their mainstream is so anti-American these days.
It is, and I think, you know, part of the problem with the media, you know, as a sort of general instrument, mm-hmm. is that they continue to slide further and further to the left. And if people don't educate themselves, they start believing that the media is reality, that mm-hmm. the media is the center. And so, you know, you watch reality television and you watch these opinion shows that pretend to be the news, mm-hmm. and it just, you know, if you don't educate yourself, you know, you forget that those ideas, the idea behind entertainment is, you know, that it's not news, that it's slightly unrealistic, and people continue to gauge themselves by the sort of concept that what they watch on TV is centrist, and it's just not. And so, you know, it doesn't take very long for people who sort of are pushed more and more to the left and become more and more liberal by self-correcting.
One thing that this program, as I said when I talked to you, is about how we can keep the new class going in the right direction. And one thing that I always suggest is getting involved, going to the town halls, writing letters, calling them. But what are the things that you think are majorly the objective towards this new class? Not only just education, but also influence, so to speak.
Sure. Well, you know, I think that the biggest problem that we face right now is that civics is no longer taught. So people over the last probably 20 or 30 years understand their rights as Americans, mm-hmm. but don't have any idea of the concept of their responsibilities. And, you know, you can see this very, very clearly in the 2008 elections. A lot of people that I've met have no idea that they are represented by a precinct. In the United States, there's 3,141 counties. Mm-hmm. And each of those counties is divided by usually about a group of 500 people in your neighborhood into a precinct. There is a Democrat and a Republican sitting in each precinct, and those people make determinations on things like zoning, whether or not you can have the Ten Commandments in front of the courthouse, whether you can have an MIA flag at the cemetery, you know, all the sort of issues that really become quite hotbed issues. In 2008, there were 200,000 empty precinct seats in the United States for Republicans. That means in 200,000 situations, in 200,000 events, there was only the voice of a liberal and no Republican to counter. And people, you know, they just have no idea that the power really comes at that level, that neighborhood level.
Yes.
And it's not, you don't have to dedicate yourself to politics. You know, a lot of people, when they first hear that they have this, you know, this ability to make changes just in their community that eventually, you know, turn into things like the committee meetings where they choose who's going to go on to run for senator, who's going to be on the ballot, the power is at the local level. People complain because they have such crappy choices on a state level. And what they don't realize is that they had the power to influence that in their own neighborhood.
Absolutely, and I agree with you. I was actually a district president, district chairman myself, and it's definitely something that you don't know about. I actually won by my own vote, to tell you the truth, because nobody knew about it.
Definitely.
I just wrote in my name, and I won by my own vote.
Definitely. Well, and that's happening time and time again. You know, people, and unfortunately it's happening on the Democrat side as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody to challenge them. And if there's nobody to challenge, then it's, you know, their liberal vote is the only one that gets put out there. And so you have communities that are going increasingly leftist in their positions on, you know, on parks and on, you know, on everything that affects you at a local level. You know, but people, you know, when you explain, hey, you know, this is what a precinct is, they're fearful that they will have to spend a lot of time politicking. And, you know, really for most people it only takes a couple hours a month. The other big place of influence is the school board. You don't have to have a kid in school to be active in the school board. Your taxes pay for that. And, you know, unfortunately, the teachers union is a, you know, sort of a vehicle for really vitriolic, left-leaning beliefs. And we can't be surprised that kids are taught in school really jaded and, you know, quite left-leaning views on politics, on history, on, you know, essentially teaching kids that Americans are bad. So people really have to get involved with their, you know, with their local events, and that really changes everything.
Oh, all politics is local, and I like how you talked about the school board, because being a New Jersey native, you know that my school board has been incredibly intriguing. One thing that I definitely agree with you in the aspect is education, because personally, I did not really see myself as a Republican until I went out of high school, and then went and did my own research, my own guidance, figured out my own agenda, because they really do drill into your heads some minority situations.
Well, they do, and I think the other thing is that they condense history down to a paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's no longer that, you know, and you can't teach it. You know, it becomes quite a big racial issue. You can't teach about the real origins of the Civil War. You can't teach about the real origins of conflicts in Vietnam, because it's all condensed down to a paragraph, and that paragraph has to be politically correct. So ultimately, it takes all of the nuances out, and it just becomes this really pat statement, and kids believe it. And there, I can't remember who said it. There is an old statement that says, you know, if you're not a liberal when you're young, you don't have a heart. If you're not a conservative when you're older,
you don't have a head.
Yeah,
that was Winston Churchill.
I think that's true.
It's absolutely true. Another objective, and you talked a little bit about involvement on the local level, and I do agree with you, but what is the objectives, or what are the factors and actions that can be done on the federal level? Because with Obamacare already risking lives, with the Bush tax cuts nearing their expiration date, as well as the unemployment insurance involvement, what aspects on the federal level do you think quote-unquote Republican radicals, or at least an American, can do?
Well, I think there's two things. One thing that I think is really important and is so topical right now is that the people that are elected have to be able to convey to you as the voter what they're doing, and you have to be able to convey to them as the electorate what you expect them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a time right now when you have the internet and people can post, you know, web posts and Twitter and all that, there's no reason for people not to be really clear, not only about what their platform is,
right,
but what they're going to do and what they're doing. I want to be able to go on my representative's site and see, okay, this is what he believes. He believes in extending the Bush tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to be able to go back once a week or get a Twitter or get an email or something that says, hey, this week this is what he did to preserve this.
Mm-hmm.
We have a situation that in Washington, and certainly on the RNC level, where people, politicians, make really generalized statements that tell you nothing.
Hmm.
The RNC website says, we support our military. But that doesn't mean anything. But, you know, does that mean we support our military to be fully funded? Do we support our military to be removed from
Afghanistan? Oh, no, I agree with you. I can't stand the RNC website lately.
It's ridiculous. And, you know, the problem is that then they can always say, see, we kept our word. Because they make it so general. And so I think that it's important that people hold their representatives' feet to the fire.
Mm.
And say, okay, what have you done for me lately? Because not only does it keep them, you know, so that they're more in touch. You know, if you have to go back every week and you have to make reckoning of what you're doing, you're less likely to lose sight of the fact that this is what you promised to do. I think that's important. The other thing that I think is really important is that in, you know, in all these bills, we have to get rid of the idea that you can just tag dozens and dozens of unrelated things into a bill and get them, you know, to be passed virtually without being read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to be honest, there are so many people out there that are so excited about politics now.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't any reason why there can't be committees of people who are reading these things, even if your representative doesn't have time to read them. And I understand, you know, if somebody's pushing through a 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 page bill and says, hey, you have to vote on this right away, that they don't have the time to read it. But that doesn't mean that they couldn't put it to a committee that could read it and summarize it.
I agree with, I love that idea. I really do, because when I hear you have to read it, we have to pass it before we can read it, it's just flabbergasting to me.
Yeah.
And I agree with the vagueness because, you know, and that's one thing that I've noticed is people are starting to get tired of. And I think that's one of the reasons why Michael Steele's going through some questionable re-election aspects is because he's supposed to be the communicator. And, you know, the political director, Jenry Collins, recently wrote a letter about, in his resignation letter, about the situation. And there's so many miscommunications, so I always say to people, don't rely on the RNC, rely on your own education.
Well, you can see, you know, that people are fed up with the RNC. And I think most people didn't really understand the RNC's goal is to keep the RNC in business.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that their goal is the same as your goal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people are now sending their money to the local candidates that they back as opposed to the RNC, and the RNC is in serious financial trouble.
Mm.
Michael Steele's big problem is that he chose really inappropriate times to talk. He really pandered to almost trying to be liked by everybody. He made really insensitive racial statements, and you know, those kind of things just leave a really bad taste in people's mouths.
Also, you know, personally, I've tried to reach out to Michael Steele to give him an opportunity to talk to the conservative youth, and it's either him or his gatekeepers, I don't know who, but they don't seem to want to involve themselves in the youth of this nation.
No, as long as they keep themselves in power. You know, when you look at somebody who is sending millions to, you know, try to keep Didi Scazzafasa in power,
mm-hmm.
you know, people that continue to try to support Arlen Specter for year after year after year,
hmm.
you know, you can see that their agenda and the rest of America's agenda are clearly, you know, not the same.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Alexandria, for being on the program. We'll
Thank
definitely
you
have you back on.